Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, everyone. This is Johnny Tan, author of From My Mama's Kitchen, Food for the Soul, Recipes for Living. Welcome to my weekly From My Mama's Kitchen Talk Radio show. My guest for this morning is Susan Gowdy. She is an inspirational speaker and an author. Susan and I will be discussing her latest book, The Journey from Fear to Love is Shorter Than You Think. This poignant memoir reveals how we can take ownership of our life and achieve whatever our hearts desire. Good morning, Susan. Welcome to From My Mama's Kitchen Talk Radio. How are you doing this morning?
Good morning, Johnny. I'm doing great. How are you?
Doing wonderful. It is a pleasure to have you on the air with me. The Journey from Fear to Love is a compelling read. It is a wonderful, inspirational book. Thank you for sharing your story with us.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for taking a look at it and inviting me on your show.
Wonderful. Let us start by getting to know you a little better. Please give us a quick walkthrough of your life from childhood to the present moment.
Well, I grew up in Chicago, Illinois, on the northwest side, and I attended local schools until high school. Then I went to Magnet High School to Whitney Young. I went to southern Illinois from there, and then I went to Arizona State University and received my bachelor's in social work and my master's degree in social work. And when I was living in Chicago, before I was even 3 years old, I was sexually abused by a 16-year-old neighbor boy. And the book kind of bounces out of that trauma, but I didn't really realize that until I was writing it. But that occurred, and I didn't really understand all the different things that because of that resulted in my life, all the fears that I had created until I was a little bit older. So, but that's where the book kind of came out of.
Interesting. So the inspiration behind The Journey from Fear to Love is out of an incident you experienced in childhood. But what actually sort of pushed you over the top in terms of needing to write the book for others?
Well, I went to school and I got my master's degree in social work. I also have a bachelor's. And so I worked with all different areas. I worked in child protective services. I worked with disabled adults. And then I went on to get my master's degree. And after that, I was doing counseling. And as I was doing, I did counseling with people. And then I learned some hands-on healing techniques. And my husband started traveling a lot. We have four children. Mm-hmm. And it just became harder and harder for me to try to really have and enjoy having a career out of my home with my four kids, and he was always gone. And I didn't want to stop doing what I was doing. I wanted to keep helping people. So I thought that the book would be a way that I could reach even more people instead of just, you know, one client at a time. My hope was that I would be able to reach several people and be able to give them the information that, you know, the healing tips and the information I had learned throughout my life from, because of that trauma, what I had done to heal myself and the steps that I took. And so that's pretty much, that was the real reason I wrote the book. And I want, like I said, I wanted to just help as many people as possible.
Interesting. So please give us a quick synopsis on how you broke the book down.
Well, I started the book, like I said, it came out of that trauma. That I kind of refer to that as my Tigger bounce. Mm-hmm. You know, that bounced me where I am today and got me to where I am today. And I wasn't going to tell the story about that, but I kept feeling urged that I had to tell that part of it, because as I was writing the book, I realized more and more that that had everything to do with, you know, everything that ever happens to you in your life is how you end up being who you are today, and has everything to do with, you know, who you become as a person. And so I couldn't leave that part out. I write about that in the introduction of the book. But the rest of the book is pretty much steps that I've taken to heal. There's like self-help tips throughout and sharing information, what I've learned from teachers throughout my life that I thought that was pertinent and what really helped me and assisted me in healing and becoming a person who has learned to take control of her life you know, in every possible way that mm-hmm. I can, and to have the life that I really want to have.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. I sense in reading your book, there's a lot of process of transference, if I may say so, from a standpoint of giving you the opportunity to transfer the anxiety, for lack of a better term, perhaps even anger, out. And in the process of doing that, probably towards the end of the book, you feel a tremendous amount of relief.
Well, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think it's because it's something that, you know, I've been living this basically mm-hmm. my whole life, and then I wrote it. And so, yeah, it's definitely a relief at the end of writing it, because it's all these things I've always wanted to be able to say, I finally put it down on paper, and things I've wanted to share. And, mm-hmm. and yeah, so there's definitely, because it starts with my story, and it's about my life and what I've done to heal, like I said. So, yeah, there's definitely, you're picking up on the right thing.
Interesting. Well, I just felt like sometimes we don't realize it ourselves, because it's a psychological thing that we go through. Every essence that we have is transferred towards our writings. In this case,
yeah.
It obviously helped you in your process of transference.
Yeah, I think anytime you write, though, I mean, there's some healing in that. You know, if people keep journals and that kind of thing, I mean, there's healing in that. And for me, writing the book, I never had to, like, think about what I was writing, and that mm-hmm. was interesting, because I never wrote unless I felt like writing. If I didn't feel mm-hmm. like writing, I didn't write. And I really do feel like I was kind of guided in the process, because a lot of information, even now, if I go back and read the book, one, I still enjoy it, and I wrote it, and mm-hmm. I still, you know, I've only had to read it a couple times for different reasons. I've had to go back through it, and it's, you know, been a couple of years after I wrote it or whatever. I still get a lot out of it myself. And so I can't help, but when I would write, I would then go back and read and go, oh, my gosh, where did this come from? And then I have to go, oh, that's right, I wrote that. So I do feel like I had some spiritual guidance in writing the book. It was because it wasn't hard to write. So I just wrote what I felt I needed to.
Sure, I understand. What is fear?
I believe that there's only two emotions. It's either fear or love. So, and I believe fear is anything that isn't love. And it's kind of, it's on a continuum. So it's the feelings that don't feel good. That's fear. When you're not feeling happy or healthy or any of those things, that's fear, and it's not love. The feelings of inspiration and joy and hope and all of that falls more toward love. Feelings of desperation and depression and anger and grief and all of those things, that's, you're in a place of fear. If it doesn't feel good and you don't feel, you know, elated about life and happy, or that, you know, you're heading in a direction of where you're excited or and feeling, you know, that joy, then you're in a place of fear.
Interesting. Can people attract fear into their life?
Oh, absolutely. Like, we attract anything else. I mean, whatever you're putting out there, like the law of attraction says, you're going to get back. So if you're in that state of fear and you're in a place of feeling, for example, hopeless, you know, and mm-hmm. just constantly in that hopeless mode, you're going to get more that's going to come to you to fulfill that hopeless feeling. It's almost, you know, it's like you're asking for it. So the more that you feel that fear and those fearful feelings, the more of that you're going to get. And that's why, you know, in the book I try to teach how to change those. You really can't change you can't think about every thought you're having, because there's so many in a day, but you can focus on how have I been feeling, and then you can start looking at, well, what were the thoughts that brought me to this place? Because you know whether you feel good or bad. You can, you know, if you really stop and think about it, you know, yeah, I'm grumpy, I'm not being pleasant with people around me, or I'm irritable, or I don't want to get out of bed. Obviously, I'm not feeling well. Then you can start mm-hmm. thinking about, what are the thoughts that I was thinking, you know, maybe before I went to bed last night or earlier today? What were the thoughts that were on my mind? And then you can start working on changing those thoughts so that you can bring yourself more to a place of love.
Interesting. In your book, you talk about being aware and being awake. What is the difference between awareness and being awake.
Well, just because you're awake, it doesn't mean you're aware. I mean, I'm awake. You know, people wake up and they've woke up for the day. They're awake. But that doesn't mean you're aware and you're paying attention. You're not in the present moment. You're not paying attention to what's really going on around you. You're not consciously aware of what's happening. You see people, and if you watch them, you can kind of see it in their eyes and their physical being and how they're moving. They're awake, but they're definitely not aware, paying absolutely no attention. And we've all had this experience when you're driving in a car and you know the person next to you is definitely not aware. They're not paying any attention. They're just kind of on autopilot. They're awake, but they're not aware. So, you know, first you have to wake up, and then you have to become aware. So for many people, you know, the wake-up might be a crisis in their life. For me, the trauma that occurred by the time I was 19, I was in a lot of physical pain. And I really thought maybe I had some kind of terminal illness. There was something really wrong at 19 years old. I shouldn't have felt that way. That I was awake, and then I was becoming aware because I was paying attention to how I was feeling, and I didn't like it. So that's kind of the difference.
How can we trigger ourselves to be more aware of our surroundings?
More aware. Well, you start, I think that's the easiest thing, and it sounds easy, but it's, you know, it's something that you have to practice and learn how to do it on a regular basis, is becoming present and focused in the moment. So that, you know, if you're doing your dishes and you're not focusing on your finances and your kids and work and whatever else, you're just doing that task, then you're aware of what you're doing in the moment. You're paying attention to that. I mean, or if you're exercising, you're in that moment, you're exercising, and that's what you're paying attention to. That's what you're doing. You're aware of how your body is moving, how you're breathing, how you're feeling. That's being aware. So I think that practicing being present and focused in the moment is a really good first step to start learning how to be aware and not just awake.
Very interesting. Basically, you're telling us not to multitask, because when you multitask, you pretty much disperse your concentration to multiple things at the same time, and you're not able to enjoy the essence of each particular thing that you actually need to focus on.
Well, it'd be a whole lot better if we didn't multitask, but I think there's very few people that are going to stop doing that because of the way the world is.
Right,
so, I mean, there's other things you can do also to slow yourself down and stop that process, because I think you're just going to automatically fall into the multitask type of thing. But, you know, then you start feeling kind of cruddy because, like you said, you're dispersed and you can't, you know, you're just all over the place. You feel chaotic. You don't feel, that's not a good feeling. Then you're in fear again. So starting with maybe finding an anchoring thought to bring you back into a space of love that will slow you down from the multitasking and remind you that, you know, look, I need to stay on task and what I'm doing and one thing at a time because I'm driving myself crazy. So, you know, with work, somebody working in a corporate environment, for example, they can't go meditate necessarily in the middle of the day, but they could have an anchoring thought that they can pull out anytime they go, okay, I'm getting crazy, things are going nuts, I don't feel good. And it could be something as simple as the birth of a child, a puppy, a place that they like to go that they really enjoy, that they take a moment, go to the bathroom, and think about that and get themselves back on track so that they can, you know, slow down, pace themselves, get into a better groove. Some circumstances force you into multitasking. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you still need to be, even though you're multitasking, trying to be present and focused in the moment as you're doing the three different things that you're doing. So as you're moving from one to the next, you know, you can in little, you know, moments be present and focused in that and then present and focused in this. And it would be nicer if we didn't have to do that.
Right. Well, parents certainly can learn this sort of focus attitude and essence from their children, because children, seems to me, are always in the present moment.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Especially very little children. I mean, if they're playing with a toy or whatever, they don't even know you're there. They're totally into what they're doing. They're playing. They're doing their thing. They're not paying attention to anything else going on around them.
there's some good out of that as well, because what happens is that they are in the moment and they're enjoying every bit of it, versus we adults, we tend to worry about the future, contemplate on the past, and we seem to forget that is what we do right now that will help shape the future.
Right, and that the past is already done and the future yeah. isn't here yet, so the only thing you really can focus on is what you're doing right now. And like you said, it's so important because that is going to affect your future so much, is paying attention to what you're doing right now and how things go. You know, if you know, even if you, like watching the little kid who's playing with the mm-hmm. toy or whatever, if they were focused on whatever was coming next, they certainly wouldn't be getting as much out of that moment and having the joy that they're having in the moment. Kids are great to watch, and so are dogs. I mean, they definitely enjoy the moment, you know?
Right,
so
right.
That's, yeah, we need to practice more of that.
Can you enlighten us about your idea regarding life is movement and change?
Well, life is constantly moving and changing. There is, I mean, there's no way, I mean, life, that's what life is. You're alive. You know, something's alive. It's always moving and changing. And so it's the idea of knowing that you can't expect everything to stay the same. You know, a lot of people hang on to that. It's kind of a control thing. They don't want anything to change. Mm-hmm. They want it to stay mm-hmm. the same. And just because it doesn't stay the same and because life is movement and change, I mean, that's a good thing, that you're moving and you're changing. You're constantly you know, like if, for example, when I've worked with people who have physical stuff going on,
mm-hmm.
You might work on something and that gets better, but they have something else going on. But they've been in pain for a really long time. It helps to remember that that's a good thing. Now it's moved. It's not staying in that one place stuck in your body. It's starting to move, which means it's changing, which means you can get better. So, I mean, that's the same thing, anything in life, you know, it's remembering, it's movement and change. So when there's a death in the family or something like that, there's to remember life is movement and change. It's okay. Things are going to move and change, but it doesn't mean it's a bad thing. Things can get better. Mm-hmm. Whatever it is, there could be relief, you know, all of those
yeah.
things.
Right, right. So true. You mentioned several times in your book about the law of attraction, and obviously that's one of the techniques that you use in helping you to facilitate your journey. How
mm-hmm.
can the law of attraction help us overcome fear?
Well, it's kind of like what we were talking about before. You said, can people attract fear into their life? So
yeah.
it's the same idea. It's that you, by using the law of attraction and understanding what that really means, that what you put out, you really are going to get back. So whatever you're thinking, whatever your feelings are, like we talked about, you're going to get more and more of that. It's once you realize that this is really up to you. I mean, so much of what goes on in your life, you have more control over than you think you do. That's why the book is The Journey from Fear to Love is shorter than you think.
Mm-hmm.
Because with fear situations, like with my situation, if I had not started to realize that the more, because I started to, like, I had some OCD-type behaviors and some of that kind of thing as a result of the trauma. And it wasn't until I was much older, because I was so young, that I started to see that. But if I hadn't have looked at that and started to see these fears, OCD stuff, that's a fear that I was having. I had to do things a specific way to make sure that, and I did it specifically to be safe. That was what was in my mind. Once I broke it down, I understood that. If I kept doing that over and over again and hadn't, you know, stopped and said, well, how do I change this? And started not acting in a place of fear and trying to move more into love, I mean, I would have kept attracting more and more of that into my life. And the physical pain I was in at 19, I was in a place of fear. My body had probably been in defense for years because of what had happened to me. So I was in a state of fear. If I had realized that, you know, I need to start putting out positive thoughts and see again, back to the life is movement and change and the example I use, that my body
yeah.
can change and it can get better and, you know, those types of things. So it's, yeah, it definitely, the law of attraction plays into all of that. Whatever you're putting out, you're going to get back more.
You mentioned about love being an integral part in overcoming fear. Does forgiveness contribute to our well-being as well?
Absolutely. Forgiveness is a huge thing. It's, you know, my mom always said that, you know, if you're not forgiving, one, you're probably got anger in there. If you're holding on to it long enough, you've got a lot of anger. And anger is like you're taking the poison and expecting the other person to be suffering. And you're really the one who's suffering with not forgiving and letting go of that. You're not, nothing's happening to the other person. They're okay. But you are definitely suffering the more you hang on to it. And your body will probably show signs of illness and different things because you're not forgiving and letting things go. I mean, all those not forgiving, all those fear feelings are wrapped up in that. The anger, the, you know, the resentment, the bitterness, all of those things. And so if you can kind of think about what that those feelings are doing to your body from the inside out, and like if you feel it, you know how bad it feels. So, I mean, what it does to you physically is really horrible. I mean, it can just rip you apart and make you very, very sick. So, yeah, forgiveness is a huge thing that we all need to practice and learn how to do, but, you know, learn how to do it so that you're really letting it go, not just saying, oh, I forgive them. It's got to be that you've done it, and I explain, give an example of how to do it in the book, but that you do it to an extent that you no longer are thinking about that person or that situation. That shouldn't be coming up anymore. So, I mean, I've had things that have taken 6 months in the past to forgive because I know that if it keeps coming up, I've got more to do. Because sometimes it will relate not only to that specific situation, but as you're peeling away at that onion, you realize, oh, this relates to multiple things in my life, and this one situation is triggered like a ton of things. So you may have to do forgiveness for a while until you can let it go, and that in the way you know that you've let it go is when it no longer comes up. When you can think about that person and there is no physical or, you know, kind of reaction, no kind of, you know, feeling of anger or resentment, when you feel peace, joy, calm, and you can actually put love toward them and say, you know, I'm sending you love, and feel that from the inside out.
So true. I'm so glad that you read extensively about Dr. Masaru Emoto's work, The Hidden Messages of Water. I really like his book. I've read his book. You have some wonderful episodes from the book in your book and how it has impacted you in terms of helping you to reconnect with your source, in this case, with God. Of course, his emphasis was gratitude, love are the most powerful emotions that we all have. And he showed that how it affects all of us in terms of vibrations and so forth. Can you tell us a little bit about his work and how it impacted you personally?
Well, one of the biggest things that I got out of his book, one, my family did the water experiment, and we actually took glasses, wine glasses. You know, I wanted more like a crystal glass that was as clear as I could get it. Put water in it, and we wrote the notes on there where he says to put thank you or I hate you or, you know, and the different. And literally you could see if you looked down into the glass, you could see that the one that said I hate you and the mean statements on those glasses. And I did this with my children when they were younger to show them. That glass was mucky looking and cloudy, where the other one that said I love you or thank you was crystal clear and looked, you know, pure. You could see all the way through it. The other one actually did get mucky. Even with the naked eye, you could see the change, which, of course, he does. The photographs that he takes, he's using, you know, specific types of lenses to really show you the beautiful crystals that show up when you put I love you. But one of the biggest things that he said in his book that really struck me, and I use it all the time to try to help people to know, is when he says that as human beings we vibrate at 570 trillion times per second. And that means we're phenomenally, you know, we have phenomenal potential and we have phenomenal power, but we deny it. Most of us deny it most of the time. And that was one of the biggest things in his book that really struck me, because once you know that, even though we're human, and we often say we're only human, which I believe we also are spiritual. That spiritual part is there with us from the beginning and never goes away. But, you know, we're living a human experience. And he's saying human beings vibrate at this rate, which that explains to me why prayer works.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can get a group of people together. If we're all vibrating at 570 trillion times per second, praying for the same thing, you know there's going to be a result from that. And they've done experiments to show that it does work. So, yeah, that's, you know, but and showing my children, because it's such an easy thing. Kids see it right away, to show them the experiment with the water and just do it in your kitchen. And they get a lot out of that.
Most importantly also, we are made up of 90% water.
Right.
And, of course, as we get older, we should maintain at least 70% of the water in us.
Yes.
So vibration affects us from inside out.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, I mean, and all of that, of course, is written in his book, and how important it is that we realize that if we, the experiments were done, like you're saying, to make the point, oh, and by the way, you're made up of almost all water. So you need to understand that if a glass of water is responding to thank you or I love you, the way that you can see it in the water in a glass, or I hate you, you know, you're stupid, or all the mean things that could be said, then, yeah, it gives you a very clear idea of what's happening to you. If you're saying those things to yourself that are horrible and ugly, or if somebody else is saying them to someone else, you know, what you're doing to that, what happens to that person from the inside out.
Right. What do you mean when you say be the director of your own life?
Well, my belief is that, like I said, we have a lot more control over our lives than we think we do. And I'm pretty straightforward in the book about, you know, this life is it's your movie. It's called Your Life. And so the chapter is about taking control of what you can control and directing your own life. Stop letting outside things or other people take control of your life, and stop using that as an excuse too, that, you know, I have no say or whatever, and tap into where you do have control and what you can take control of, and start directing your life in the way you want it to go. And some of the things are with changing your thoughts. You know, that's a really important thing to do, because or your beliefs, because everything starts with those beliefs. Changing the things that you can, so that you can be the director of your own life, and stop letting other people or other things direct where your life is going.
Certainly. You're basically talking about taking ownership of our actions and our thoughts and so forth. There is no doubt that reality is the fact that when you're a child, yes, you are vulnerable, even though you have the opportunity to take charge of your life, but you have limited capacity to do that because of adults, for example, or parents' influence and so forth. But as an adult, there is a fine line somewhere along the line when you are an adult, and that can vary in age for each individual, so to speak. But the point is, ultimately, you are the author of your destiny, basically.
Absolutely. And when I did counseling, I would have people come in and let them have that first session, and I would allow them, I called it the bitch session. Go ahead.
Yeah.
Blame it on whoever you're going to blame it on. Tell me whose fault, whatever. Just give me the whole, you know, history here. And they would do that. And I was working with adults. And they would do that. And then at the end of the session, I would say, okay, so how old are you? And, you know, I'm 35. And where do you live? I live in my own house. Do you have children?
Yeah.
Yes. Do you live with the mom and dad and whoever it is? Are you under the circumstances of what you're blaming everything on anymore? And most of them were no longer. So then I would say, okay, so now you're an adult and you have choices. So you can take control. And so when you come back, we're moving from here and we're moving forward. We're not looking at that anymore because it doesn't pertain. You're not under their roof anymore. You're not living in their home anymore. They're not even around. So you have control. And that's a huge thing, you know, for people to be able to realize that. Just because they had control of them as a child and those things happened, it's realizing that they are free now as an adult to make choices and do things differently.
Sure. There are physical restrictions, perimeters, so to speak, that's holding you back, and there are psychological restrictions that's holding
exactly.
you back. And it's a whole lot easier, actually, to break that down if you are having your mind align with specific things that you want to get accomplished. That brings me to the next question I have for you. How do our habits become our values and destiny?
Well, I'm trying to break this down for you. Like, I have a habit that I've had forever, and it actually became probably a, I probably was addicted to it a little bit, but it's the exercise. I have a habit of exercise. I exercise on a regular basis. I take good care of myself. That habit, that one habit that is something healthy and good for me, expanded and turned into many other things because I started with that, and then it was what was I eating and what was I drinking and what was because if I'm going to take care of my physical body, then all these other habits, well, then that turns into these are my values. This is my standard of living. And, of course, my destiny, because of that habit, is going to look pretty good compared to if I wasn't doing that, taking care of myself. So, you know, if somebody has a habit of smoking, you know, that's going to have a different result, what their values are and what their destiny will be. I mean, their values are going to be different than mine because I don't smoke. I mean, so the values are going to be totally different. And then, of course, their destiny will be too.
Sure, definitely. If you set up a goal, you need to look to make sure that your behavior tendencies align with those goals. If it doesn't, then you have to adjust either the goal to match up with your behavior tendencies, or then obviously you have to change your behavior tendencies to support the goals that you have set forth.
Well, and that's like, you know, the difference between someone who actually makes their goal and somebody who doesn't. I mean, it might be something they say out loud to you, I want to do this, and then you watch their actions and go, well, I don't think so. Because if you really wanted to, you know, you wouldn't be doing these other things that you're doing. You have to change what you're doing to go for the goal.
Why should we consider ourselves worthy of love, fun, and joy? You mentioned this in the book, and I think it's one of the critical areas where when you embrace this, your thought process changed.
Well, my belief is that the reason that we need to consider ourselves that way is because that's how we came here. I believe that we, you know, I talk about source or God or spirit. I don't care what you call it, universe, but I believe we came from a place of love. And that's how we came into the world, and that's what we are, you know, from the very beginning.
Mm-hmm.
It's as we're here that that starts to dissipate and we start to forget. So it's remembering that that's what you are. You came from, in my view, God, and I see God as love. So then you're love. That's what you are, and that's what you're here for. And so if you're that, then you have to know that you're worthy of having love, fun, and joy in your life. I mean, how can you not be worthy of that if I consider us to be children of God? We came from that space, so we have to be worthy of that. You know, if God were somebody that could speak to you, I see God as an energy source. So that feeling is what you get within yourself of, you know, God is with you. There's nothing negative that would be told to you. There's nothing, you would never be told you're not worthy, you're not valued, you're not beautiful. None of that would be told. So in my mind, there is nothing else other than to know that we must be worthy of love, fun, and joy, and that's what we came here for, is to enjoy our lives and to spread that. Because if you're doing that, then, of course, you know, your energy and all of that's going to go out to everybody who's around you. Everybody's going to be affected by it. It's contagious. And that's what you want to do is, like, put that out there. Shine your light as bright as you can so that others benefit from that. The more we do that, the more love that you're going to see and people enjoying their lives and having fun. And, you know, we could end wars. Lots of good things could happen if everybody would learn and realize that they are worthy of this and that we are valued.
The word you use, contagious, is so important, because if you are fearful well, that fear is contagious as well.
Absolutely.
Right. And, of course, if you are always having this wonderful, loving energy around you, that energy is contagious as well.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. I mean, it's an energy. You know, it's like that magnet, that pull. Like, if you've been around people that are just not nice people, kind of nasty, really mean, you know, not nice, you'll feel yourself, if you're not one of them, you'll feel yourself pull back from that. You'll actually maybe even turn and walk in the other direction. And then you don't even know you're doing it. And they'll be like, what was that? I just didn't feel like I wanted to be close to them. Because we have a magnetic field around our bodies that kind of protects us from that. So it's almost like you bounce off of them. Oh, no, that doesn't work for me. But if somebody were in that same space, you know, it's a, if you can't beat them, join them. Some people do that. So they might just join in with them, and they become the ones that are sitting around complaining with each other about how awful life is and rotten. And so, yeah, you're attracted to whatever it is.
Right. You will feel that energy getting zapped out of you, pretty much.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, have you had that happen? I mean, you're walking, and you'd be in a public place, and all of a sudden it's like, I don't know. I just, you know, you're not like you're thinking about it, but for some reason you're in a crowd and you want to get away from whoever this person is to the right of you or whatever.
Right,
you just don't, there's not a good feeling there. And the more we are living in a space of love, the more you're going to feel more and more and more of that, which is a great thing because it gives you direction without even having to think. You're going to have, you'll know, this is not a good place for me. I need to move away from this.
Right.
And that will go throughout your whole life. You'll start to realize without thinking that I just need to get out of here.
Right. Well, your book talks about being awake and then being aware. The most important thing is that you yourself will realize this when you go out, you will encounter situations, you encounter people that either they energize you or they deflate you. And that's your choice to decide where you want to hang out. Or whom you want to hang out with.
And the choice isn't hard once you pick love over fear.
Right. Can you elaborate Bruce Lipton's concept of the biology of belief and the power of consciousness, matter, and miracles? By the way, Bruce did a wonderful job in endorsing your book. Congratulations on that. And, of course,
you
use his techniques quite a bit in facilitating your journey as well. So please share your thoughts about that.
Well, that's Bruce Lipton's book, The Biology of Beliefs and Power of Consciousness, Matter and Miracles. That's his first book. He's written more since then. But the basic concept behind it is that, as a scientist, he has proven that belief underlies everything and that those beliefs we start to get our core beliefs when we're very young. And he says between the age of 2 and 6, you're kind of in this hypnotic state. So you're like a little sponge. So whatever environment you're in, that you're living in your family, your parents' home, or, I don't know, being raised in an orphanage or by relatives, or it doesn't matter, foster home, whatever environment you're in at that stage where you're this little sponge, you're absorbing everything that's going on around you. So your beliefs are created, like the core beliefs are really created at that point in your life because those are downloaded into the subconscious part of the brain. So if there's a fear around money in the house, for example, or a fear around health, whatever it is, you're going to, you know, even at that young age, you start to absorb all that. You're putting that into your subconscious part of the brain, and that's kind of directs the way your life is going to go, and unless you change those beliefs. So you're going to kind of go through your life and having, because the subconscious runs the show. I mean, it's like the computer; it's running the program of the computer of your life, and so you getting to the subconscious is the most important thing to make these changes. You can use willpower, like he says, but it doesn't last like actually getting to the subconscious part and changing the beliefs. Using willpower is a lot of work, and it's frustrating, and it might last for a while, but it's not gonna last forever. So,
very interesting concept. How about the BEST technique? BEST.
Well, that's a technique. that's a technique, and I actually met Bruce at a BEST conference he was speaking at. And that's a technique. It's called Bioenergetic Synchronization Technique, and they just shortened it to BEST. You can see why. And it's basically a hands-on healing technique. It was developed by a chiropractor who realized, really, that, you know, doing just the physical stuff with the body wasn't enough to make changes that would hold, that the physical and the emotional part of the body, you have to work on the whole thing. You can't just work on, you know, one or the other and have changes hold. So he created this technique which peels away at the onion, basically, and they use, like, acupressure points on the body. It's very non-invasive, very simple. And they, through some muscle testing, and he's got other information that you're able to look at to find information off of a few different charts that he's created. You're able to, through the person's body and using their body to do the muscle testing and checking leg lengths and all of that, pull out information from the subconscious of what is the interference in this body. What's causing, and most people come in with a physical complaint, what's causing that? And you will find the emotional tie to what's going on there. Once you clear out what's underneath that, the emotional interference that's causing the body not to work at its highest ability, then the body will start to heal and to release and let go and function like it's supposed to. For example, when I was about 27, and mind you, I was abused before I was 3. That's 24 years later. My daughter was 2, so she was about the age I was. And I loved playing with her, enjoyed being around her, but memories were being triggered from the abuse. And I became really sick. I had the physical stuff going on when I was younger, but then where she was that age, I started having sinus infections one right after another. I never had one before, and I was sick and tired of being sick and tired. So I saw my best practitioner. At that time, I went in kind of waving my imaginary white flag saying, I'm sick and tired of being sick and tired. And when I went in, he went through the process of BEST. I mean, and here I am going with sinus infections. Mm-hmm. And he pulled out 2 words, sexual abuse, and he pulled out an age, 0 to 5. And I almost yelled at him because I'd never told him any of this. Mm-hmm. And thought, how the heck did you know? And he moved me into a private room because of the subject matter. We finished the process, went through, pulled out the other information that needed to be cleared to clear out the interference. And I never had another sinus infection. I've never had one in my life ever again. And I also had a reoccurring nightmare. Now, here's the benefit. Mm-hmm. The little boost that you get with some of these techniques that you don't expect, they're the bonuses. That nightmare that I had, which was related to the trauma, and I had it almost every night, blood-curdling screams, you know, white as a ghost, just hyperventilating, and that nightmare went away, too, and I never had it again either. And that was after, you know, I went in and said, I'm ready to be well. And that's the key with any of these types of techniques. The person has to be ready. You can't, like, make them do it. It's like sending someone to rehab. The family forces them. They'll keep going in and out of rehab over and over again until they decide that they want to do it. So that's the way these techniques work. I was ready to be well, and it was boom, it was that fast. I was well.
Yeah, you were ready to receive the healing process.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Can fear contribute to one's well-being as well?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, fear is, like we've talked about, fear's the, to me, it's a parasite. You know, fear is not something that's well, healthy and well at all. I mean, it's that fear just kind of, the more you leave it there, the bigger it gets, the more things start to corrode and fall apart. And, you know, it's the foundation just crumbles. It's going to, cause everything to not be well in your life because it's, you know, you've become so inundated with just fear. Nothing good is going to come from that.
Do you look at fear from a perspective of other people may look at it in the sense that fear is somewhat healthy if it's contained. For example, fear of losing makes us work harder to win.
Yeah, I think as long as you can eventually let go of that, because if you're constantly afraid of losing, then you're constantly going to be in fear, and you're even if you win, I mean, then you're going to be a fear of losing again, and it just keeps replicating itself over and over and over again. I think it should be not a fear of losing. I mean, fear can be a wake-up call. Fear is like you're afraid because you got sick, and you don't want to be sick anymore. And like I was afraid, I thought I had some kind of terminal illness. But if I stayed in that constant being afraid of being sick, then I think I'd probably be sick all the time because I was constantly... Again, law of attraction. I'm constantly in fear of being sick, so I'm constantly bringing that back. So with your example, a fear of losing, it would be better to be a desire of winning. I have this desire. I have this dream. I have this goal, and seeing it in this place of, you know, where it's light and love, and I can't wait to get there, that would be better because those feelings that go along with it are exhilarating and uplifting and all of that, where, I'd turn it around is what I would do.
So the fear of dying forces you to go to the doctor, and you need to turn it around and say, the joy of living.
Exactly. And then if you go even one step further, it's like, why is there fear around dying? Because I don't believe that we actually die. I don't believe in death. I believe that, you know, our spirits, like, we talked about earlier, we're spiritual before we're human. The spirit part never goes away, so that spiritual part of you continues to go on and on and on and on. The spirit can't die, so take away that fear, and then you don't even have that fear anymore, and you will enjoy your life at a much better level, much higher level, if you're not afraid of dying, right?
Right. When can love become unhealthy?
When it's not really love, and when you're not, to me, one of the most important things somebody could do for themselves is you have to love yourself before you can love anyone else. And so you really have to love yourself first. I mean, truly, knowing that you're worthy, knowing that you're valued, knowing, you know, I am a child of God, whatever it is that makes you realize how important you are and that you really, truly love yourself and see yourself as beautiful and powerful and all of those things, then you can go out and love other people. But until you do that, you can't. So, I mean, love can be unhealthy when you're faking it, when you're out there, you know, some people are just being people pleasers and they see that as loving somebody. You know, but then those are the ones that if they're just really people-pleasing and they haven't loved themselves first, then they will go out and do people-pleasing. And then they become bitter and resentful and all those things. And then, you know, that turns into that domino effect of what happens with those feelings to your entire being from the inside out. So Maya Angelou, who just made her transition, had a quote that I absolutely love. She says, "I do not trust people who don't love themselves and yet tell me I love you." And then she said, "There's an African saying, which is, be careful when a naked person offers you a shirt." I think there's a lot of naked people running around offering people shirts. I mean, they're not, you cannot love others and put love out unless you love yourself first. So, yeah, it can be unhealthy when it's not really love. Love itself is not unhealthy.
Right.
It's when you're faking it and it's not real love. Right. Or you're mistaking it. You know, young people mistake infatuation for love.
Right.
That's not what it is. So love itself can never be unhealthy. True love.
Right. Right. So true. If you turn love into obsession, that's unhealthy as well.
Right. Yeah. Because then you're not even in love anymore. You're obsessed. And obsession is a fear-based feeling.
Precisely. How can your book be used to strengthen relationships?
Well, we just talked about one of the most important things, and I write about it, is that you have to love yourself first. So if you're loving yourself first, you're in a relationship with your, you know, husband, wife, whatever, you're loving yourself first, I mean, they're going to benefit from that, and the whole relationship is going to benefit from that, because what you're putting out is that. So they're going to put that back out to you. It's going to keep bouncing back and forth in the relationship that you know, you're putting out love, and you're living in a space of love, and you're living at a higher level. You're vibrating closer to, you know, love. And so as you're vibrating that, it's any relationship you're around, like you talked about before, we talked about being contagious, that's going to be contagious, and those relationships are going to get stronger and be better and more joyful and fun and light, you know, all of that.
Mm-hmm. That's true. What would you like for the readers to gain from reading The Journey from Fear to Love?
I want them to know, without any doubt at all, how powerful they are, and that they have the ability within themselves to make the changes they want to make to have the life they want to have. And I want them to be able to embrace their power and live in love. It's Maya Angelou again, she writes, I believe in living a poetic life, an artful life. Everything we do is a part of a larger canvas we are creating. And I think that's what we need to remember. You're creating this life. And so everything you do, I mean, living a conscious life, I want them to participate and be conscious of what they're doing in their life. Stop blaming other people, or other situations. Stop using excuses. No more excuses. I want them, once they know that they have the power within themselves, which is probably the biggest fear we all have, is our own power. That 570 trillion times per second. You mean I can, you know, having that power, once we realize we have it. When I first realized it, I remember going, oh, wow, that's great, that's fantastic, freedom, power, I feel great. And immediately after that, I went, oh, crap, I can no longer blame my husband, I can't blame my kids, I can't blame my parents. I am now 100% accountable for my life. And that's scary. And I think that's why some people don't want to change, because that's really scary. And they think there's power in being that victim, or, you know, being in that place of fear. And for a while there might appear to be power, but after a while there is no more power. People catch on and they don't want to deal with your manipulations and all of that, using your victimhood or your fear to get what you want. Mm-hmm. I want people to know that they are very powerful. They have no more excuses, and they need to embrace their power and live in love.
Interesting. Well, it's no longer fun then, because you have to take ownership.
Yeah. Well, and it's a lot of fun then. I mean, because you are taking ownership, so you have a lot more control. Like Maya says, you're creating this canvas. You're creating it. So, I mean, you know, it's now you have to live more consciously. You can't be flaky about it. You have to pay. But also understand, I mean, we are human, living a human experience. So, you are allowed to flake out here and there and wig out or have whatever your moments are.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's just remembering how to get back on the path. It's okay. I mean, we all falter. I'm not saying you're going to go out and you're living this perfect life and you're better than everybody else around you. You're living in this world with all these other people around you. We're picking up all the energy that's all around us. You might be stuck in a place where the energy is really negative and it makes it harder to rise above. But you can keep doing that and creating those habits and changing, you know, a little bit at a time. Keep doing it. And your standards for yourself will rise to the point that you will never allow yourself to come back down any lower. I mean, and if you do, you will quickly move yourself back up. And you'll use things to, you know, I use a mirror technique in my bathroom if I'm having a off day and I need to go scream and yell and have a fit. I go in my bathroom where I can see myself, I can hear myself, it echoes, it's ugly, I don't like what I see. Very quickly, my self-talk in the mirror turns to what I want to see, because I can't stay in that ugly mode for a long time. And that very rarely happens anymore, but that is a space, you know, a place I can go and do that. And because you can see yourself and hear yourself, you kind of snap out of it. It's not attractive.
Right. Where can someone go to buy your book, get more information about you, and keep up with your latest happenings?
My website is journeyfromfeartolove.com, journeyfromfeartolove.com. The book is on sale there at Barnes & Noble and Amazon, and you can get it also as an e-book. So everything's pretty much on the website. I mean, they can find out Facebook, Twitter, all that. It's all on there.
Mm-hmm. Wonderful. How has writing The Journey from Fear to Love impacted you personally?
Well, you kind of brought it up earlier, and mm-hmm. you're exactly right. Going through the process of writing it, one, it keeps me on track. It makes me, I'm not going to just talk the talk. I walk the walk. Mm-hmm. So it keeps me on my path, and it keeps reminding me over and over. You know, I've wrote the book, and now that I'm out talking about it, I'm constantly, you know, checking myself and reminding myself that this, you're speaking these words, so you can't go out there and live a lie. You need to be living what you're speaking. That, and I have a lot of integrity, so there's no other way I'm going to do it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Wonderful. What is next for you?
Well, hopefully the next book will come out soon, and I'm supposed to be doing some speaking engagements, and that will be on the website. The next book is called Drama, 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 Bitch, Bitch, Bitch. So that should be out pretty soon, and that's, you know, exactly about that, how we kind of get stuck in drama and the victimhood and all of those things, and how to get out of that cycle.
Interesting title. By the way, we're coming close to the end of the hour. Since our show is about people, family, and living life, would you like to share a recipe for living with our listeners this morning?
There's not too many ingredients. It's, you know, we've talked about a lot of different things, so now I think mm-hmm. people can kind of understand what I'm going to give them. One, I want you to be who you really are. I mean, that's what I do, be who I really am, knowing that I'm worthy and valued and I deserve this, and live that truth. No more excuses, and embrace your power and live in love.
Very interesting. That's a wonderful recipe for living. Susan, thank you for the great recipe for living and for spending this hour with me on From My Mama's Kitchen Talk Radio. To all our listeners, thank you for being with us. Please join me next Tuesday morning. My guest will be Hilary Saffron. She is a professional clown and an entertainer. Hilary and I will be discussing her latest book, Laughing in the Rain, Self-Care for the Storms of Life. The book will show us how to laugh in the rain even if our umbrella has holes. For additional information about this show and future shows, please go to fmmktalkradio.com. Thank you for listening and have a blessed week. Susan, it has been a pleasure. Thank you again and have a blessed day.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Bye-bye.